If you want to know if your farmer who you buy chicken from is raising his meat birds well, the feet 90% of the time will tell you. If you pick up chickens' feet of a Cornish cross and they have sores forming, that means the management is off by the person overseeing those birds.
Hi there, friend. Welcome to the Homestead Journey podcast. I'm Erin, and I'm absolutely thrilled that you are here. This isn't just any homesteading podcast. It's a journey we're taking together. Join me as I, along with my family and guests, share stories, educate, and lean into encouraging you in the art of homesteading. Each episode, we'll dive into the nitty-gritty of life on the farm, sharing tips, tricks, and tales to inspire and equip you on your own homesteading journey. And remember, no matter where you are on this path, you are not alone. I'm so glad you're here. I am absolutely geeking out over the guest that I got to interview today, you guys. I got to talk with John Moody, who is an author, a speaker. He is part of the movers and shakers of the homestead movement. He rubs elbows with Joel Salatin. He's talked at Polyface Farm. He's a regular speaker at the Homesteaders of America, the Rogue Food Conference. John has been doing homesteading since early 2000s, and he has been doing it in a way that I really look up to and admire. Organic farming, humane farming practices, kind of getting back to traditional farming and not so much the big agricultural, like fertilizers, all the additives. It's more like leaning into what God has given us in the land that we have and stewarding it well so that it produces for us. And so my interview with him today was just so insightful. He shared so much wisdom. I was literally taking notes the whole time. Even if you are not in the part of your journey yet, or even considering doing butcher birds or doing meat of any kind, just the insight that he has into homesteading in general. We talked about gardening. We talked about so many different aspects besides just like the meat part of it, that you will definitely gain understanding, encouragement, and insight from this interview. And so I just cannot wait to jump in with you guys. Also, I want to say that for the first time ever, I get to say that I have a sponsor for this podcast, and it is Roots and Harvest. You guys, this is an amazing company. It's family owned, and it celebrates and supports homemade, homegrown living. Based in Ohio, and staffed by DIY enthusiasts, Roots and Harvest offers traditional supplies and hard to find items for every corner of your homestead, from preparing and preserving food to making bread and cheese, to even doing what we're doing, raising the backyard poultry. Find inspiration, how-to advice, and supplies that you need for your journey at rootsandharvest.com. I also have a coupon code with them. It's Erin10 for 10% off your order. I do believe that also gives you free shipping. And they have so many amazing things on there. So we are actually using their products for the processing of our birds, and it just makes it feel all the more real that we are doing Cornish cross from beginning to end. And so we got some of the supplies in from UPS yesterday. We're getting some more delivered in just a couple days. And I cannot wait to go through this whole process. Like, obviously I'm nervous. This is our first time processing birds. We have raised animals for meat, but we haven't done the whole thing. And I just think that it adds a level of respect, a level of honor to the animal, to just kind of X out the undue stress of having them leave the property to be dispatched, that we can just do that all at home and that we can do it at home well. And so I'm so glad that I get to bring you guys along for this whole process from beginning to end of raising Cornish cross for the first time, and to be able to do that with Roots and Harvest in my corner, providing high quality products, and then being able to talk to John today and really getting a great understanding of how to do it. And so I just hope that you guys will enjoy the episode today. Okay, hello everyone. It is so good to see you guys today. I have John on. John, I'm going to just let you introduce yourself, but he has been part of the homestead movement. Going with who's who, and you go Joe Salatin and like Polyface Farm, and you're just doing the whole shebang. So I feel like I'm talking to a celebrity here. But I'm so excited that you're on, and I'm just going to let you introduce yourself and kind of tell everyone a little bit about you.
Yeah, so I'm John. our family started homesteading, I guess, back around 2009, after I started a local food buying club in Louisville. And I had farmers look at me and say things to me like, well, you can't raise fruit without spraying it with chemicals. You can't raise animals without giving them antibiotics. And I was just like, you know, like, what did people do before 1960? Like, did everybody die? You know?
Yeah.
So it'd have these, it always baffled me that people thought the way we'd been doing things for 40 years and the way we've been doing things for the past 40, 50 years are completely non-historical, are the only way you could possibly do things. So I kind of got a bit indignant and I was just like, fine. I was like, you tell me I can't raise pastured chickens that will give me eggs. Well, then I'm going to go show you can do it. And so we ended up buying 35 acres about an hour outside of Louisville and we started homesteading. And I realized that it was both a lot harder and a lot easier than I thought it was going to be. and many adventures ensued.
Oh my goodness. Then that's so true. It's like what we're doing is not original, but I think the homesteading movement, especially the past 5 years, is different in a shift of we're trying to get back to how it was before because we see the broken system and we don't want to recreate a broken system that isn't working on our own farms. Like we don't want to use the, like we're doing it to get away from the commercialism of the whole process. And so, but there is pushback when you are trying to, was it raise your own meat birds, do a dairy cow, like whatever it is, not doing it the traditional way. And so I think sometimes it's hard for people to access that information because they're afraid they're going to be criticized for trying to do it a different way. But you have decided to do that. And so you guys have been doing that since 2009. So obviously you're still around. It must have worked. You haven't died. So that's exciting. And so when did you get into the meat? Yeah, right. And so how did you start with meat birds? Because we're kind of talking about that today, our journey. We just talked about bathroom birds. I have my meat birds in my bathroom right now. You said you're getting yours pretty soon for this season. Was that kind of your first step into homesteading or how did that go about?
Well, so we lived in Louisville and my first step into homesteading was raising a container garden when we lived in an apartment. This would have been 2005, 2006. I had a container garden at my apartment building. And on my way to and from class, I'd move the containers around the courtyard of the, you know, outside of, you know, to make sure they had great sun while I was gone doing my master's work. And I gorilla worm composted in the basement of our apartment building. So I would sneak down at the end of every day with a little container and I was gorilla worm composting and then like gardening. So that's like how we started. Cause I really took, you know, Joel Salatin, I really like when he said years and years ago, that don't assume you will finally do the things you dream about once you have land or once you have a tractor or once you're not doing them now, you're not going to do them later because it's not an issue of opportunity. It's an issue of initiative. If you really want to do these things, you will do them now, even if it means having chickens in your bathroom. But I love what Joel said is if you're not doing what you can where you are, you're never going to do things later. You know, the issue isn't that you don't have land. The issue isn't that you don't have animals. The issue is never opportunity. The issue is initiative and ownership. And so even when we were living in an apartment, I was always looking for who's a farm I can go help with? Who, you know, what's something I can grow in a container on a windowsill? What compost can I make in my basement? What changes could we make now? Even with the limited opportunity we had, because if a person isn't maximizing the opportunity they already have, more opportunity isn't going to help them later. As we were joking about before we started, you know, even if it means having chickens in your bathroom,
yes,
if that's what it takes, you'll do it.
Yes. So let that be a word for anybody out there who has been on the fence or feels like they have to have something more before they start. It is never that way. And I'm telling you, like, if there was someone, I mean, we have 100 acres right now, but we started, me and my husband, our first two houses were in the city, and I had chickens in my backyard, and I always had a garden. And so it's like, we're looking for a milk cow right now, but I've been getting raw milk from local people for 2+ years. So it's like, it's this building up. And that is so, I think, beneficial too for a starter, because if you're able to experience or help someone or start small in an apartment, you build the skill set slowly so that you don't feel so overwhelmed when suddenly one day maybe you buy a couple acres and you want to do the thing. You have taught yourself over time these skills, which is so valuable.
Yeah, people just need to do what they can where they can. But you had asked what animals we started with.
Yeah.
Meat birds were one of the very last animals we ever did.
Wow.
So we started with laying chickens and laying ducks and beef cattle. So because we were getting our raw milk from a local raw milk dairy that supplied our buying club. And he had all of these extra Jersey boys, you know, because you're not keeping all the boys.
Yeah.
What are you going to do with all of these beautiful Jersey boys? We would start buying a bunch of their extra Jersey boys every year and raise out beef on our farm. That, you know, beef are still our absolute favorite homestead animal. Raising Jersey boy cows for beef is just immensely fun. We have fond memories. At the time, we had two kittens, and these beef cows were probably 7-8 months old. They might have been even a little younger. And these, these little cat, these not little cows, but only, you know, 4 or 5 month old cows would play chase in the pasture with our kittens.
Oh my gosh.
It was like the most adorable thing. Because the beef cattle had been bottle fed.
That is so cute. That's like something you see in a picture or something.
Oh yeah, it was adorable. You know, so we only started meat birds while we didn't raise meat birds ourselves, we had done a lot of other poultry, and we had butchered by the time we finally got our own meat birds. We had helped raise and butcher thousands of meat birds on other farms and homesteads. I used to wake up at like 3 a.m. and drive down to Stanford, Kentucky, which was about 2 hours from Louisville, where we lived at the time, to help a small farm butcher 200-400 birds. And then bring back a couple hundred for my buying club in Louisville. That's when I was younger. I was much more, less kids and more energy.
Oh my gosh. Well, that is one way to jump into it.
Yeah. You know, so we had a lot of experience with meat birds, some raising experience, and a lot of layer raising experience transfers to meat birds. You know, if you've done laying chickens, it's just like a really condensed timeline when you're dealing with meat birds, and then a couple special considerations. And we had already acquired a tremendous amount of butchering experience.
That's good for people to know too. And I think most people do start. So I feel like we're a little bit similar, but you definitely had more experience in the fact that like our first year here, we raised pigs because the turnaround for pork was very quick. We bought them in the spring. We were able to harvest them in the fall. My husband wanted to harvest them, but then we ended up, he had some work issues. And so we had to outsource that. We would like to do that at some point in time. But that was... What we thought was going to be easy was not. Those pigs were the biggest escape artists. Oh my gosh. They were constantly out, and they were I know now why my parents, they all grew up raising pigs when they were young with their families, and they never did it themselves. And I'm like, why not? And now I know why. It's because they got scarred when they were young. But we've purchased beef from a friend, but that was kind of what we were hoping too for our dairy cow is if she throws a heifer, we want to keep two. But then at that point in time, we figured we would just do like a beef cross and then kind of take care of our meat that way. So we have been, I mean, we've had chickens our whole marriage about 13 years. But this is the first time that we're stepping into the Cornish cross or the meat chickens. And so I think like the timeline kind of worries me a little bit because it is so quick. It's like, oh my gosh, you get them. And then you have 6 weeks and you can't keep them longer than that, really. So you have to have a plan to get the whole process done. So I guess let's just jump, like, based on your history, what would you tell someone who's considering meat birds to know if this is the right time for them, or if maybe they need to hold off or be prepared more? Like, what are some common issues that you find?
Yeah. So with meat birds, it's one of the things we schedule life around. We usually raise two rounds of meat birds a year, and we don't schedule major things when we're raising a batch of meat birds. You know, we don't want to be away from the farm. If we need like a 5 or 6 day family trip, somebody else can care for our laying chickens. Somebody else can feed the pigs. But meat birds, we tend to, you know, really, we schedule them into a block where life is going to be a little bit less hectic, if possible. And we're going to be a little bit more, at least one of the older members of the family is always going to be around to care for them. Because since their lifespan is very short, if something goes wrong, it tends to go wrong quickly. And so, you know, you really just, meat birds require actual management. You know, like, laying chickens can thrive on a certain amount of neglect. You know, they'll lay a little bit less for you. But meat birds, you know, especially once you're after like the 4 or so week mark, if it's a hot day and one of their waterers leaks out and you got stuck in traffic at work, you might come home to half of your tractor of meat birds dead. You know, it's they're just a more finicky animal to raise. So that's one of the things I tell people is, if you're going to do meat birds, you know, start with less if you can, to bring the cost down per chick. Order with some other people. So, you know, because a lot of people will be like, oh man, like, well, 100 chicks is basically half the price per chick of 50 chicks. I'm basically getting 50 chicks free. But the more meat birds you have, the more finicky the management becomes. You know, so we always tell people, like, yeah, when you're first doing it, maybe raise like 25 meat birds, which means you and 4 friends split a batch of 100 meat birds. But don't overcommit yourself right out of the gate, especially if you're not used to raising them and not having a lot of other poultry experience to boot. And so the other big thing with meat birds is you really have to follow the rules with them, you know, like proper brooder space for meat birds, non-negotiable, you know, sufficient warmth, because so this is your first time ever doing them and you have them in your bathroom at the moment.
Yes.
It's like such a different world than watching a laying bird. Because the meat birds go from being these cute little puffy yellow things to looking like alien gangle creatures over 7 to 9 days.
Oh, really? And wow.
They're really, really ugly from around week 1.5 to like week 4 or 5. Just horribly ugly because they physically grow so fast. Their feathering and other things just doesn't keep up with them.
Sure.
Which makes them less resilient. So, because they're not well feathered, they're not as well insulated, they're more, you know, so temperature swings, get it, you know, they're not as robust when you're doing meat birds. They require more management, more care, more protection than some other things.
So people need to be... So if you have concerns or you're not sure, this is really good because they are more high maintenance. Usually I feel like a lot of times the opposite is like, oh, you know, you're overthinking it. It's too hard, or you're making it too hard, especially for like the laying birds and stuff. But for the Cornish cross or meat birds, it is something that you need to consider because with the extreme growth rate, you're right. There's just, and there is a lot of issues. My parents raised them when I was very young, but they outsourced the butchering and everything. So I remember rotating them in their little square box, like throughout the past year, but we did have quite a few die. And so we did 25. So I feel good. I feel like I'm right where you told us we should be then. We have 25 because I figured maybe like 4 or 5 might die and then we'll be able to like harvest 20. So, okay. So I feel that that makes me feel good right now. And so do you have like a preference? Do you just get a mix like male and female, or do one race faster out than the other? Or is there any difference in that?
We just get straight run.
Straight run. Okay.
We don't care if they're male or female. Because the difference in price for us, and most of the farmers I know just get straight run. And, you know, what we do, we usually raise 60 at a time.
Okay.
I really like that number for us because we do 2 butcherings that way. 2 30 chicken butcherings.
Okay.
Because me and my kids, we can butcher 30 chickens in just over an hour.
Wow.
And so, butchering is the part where I think a lot of people think it's harder than it actually is. The raising, I think most people think is easier than it is with the Cornish cross. And then people think the butchering is going to be harder than it is, but they're really, really easy to butcher. Once you've worked with anybody who's done it, if you spend one day butchering Cornish with a person who knows what they're doing, and then go home and watch some videos and review, or I'd really say, do it twice if it's a smaller day of butchering. But if you've helped somebody butcher Cornish just 2 or 3 times and watch some videos, you'll be able to butcher them pretty effectively yourself the first time without too much drama. By doing 60 birds and doing 2 butcherings, when we get to our first butcher date, we take all of the biggest birds. And that gives any of the runtier birds less competition for another 10 days. So they size up nicely if anybody's fallen behind. Because this is a problem you'll have with Cornish cross, especially once you start raising larger numbers. There's always like the feed enforcer Cornish cross. You're always going to have a couple really large boys and girls, and they knock everybody else away from the feeders. You know, they're just like, they're the
I've heard they're mean to each other.
Oh yeah. They're not, again, they look like alien monsters, and they're not one of my friends, him and his wife raised Cornish cross a year or so ago. And after doing it, he vowed, he's like, we're just buying chicken. We're never raising these things again. He's like, they smell bad. They're ugly. They're mean. He's like, their only redeeming feature is they taste somewhat good at the end.
I feel like the meat from the store lately, like, I don't know if it's just me, but it does not taste the same as it used to. Like, I'm so sick of store-bought meat, especially I think because we have been having a lot of homegrown stuff lately. You're like, there is definitely a difference with that. And you can finish what you were going to say, but I was going to ask too, like, is there a benefit to rotating them on the ground? Like, does that help the fertility of your soil? Do you do that in a specific area? Like, how does that go once you move them from the bathroom outside?
I guess this is another common mistake. Chickens drop an incredible amount of fertility. Why is it most people's stationary chicken coops, the area around the coop after a couple years resembles the surface of the moon?
Because it's too hot, right? Isn't it too hot?
Well, it's too much fertility in one spot. So, you should be doing soil tests on your land. And, depending on the amount of space you have, you really want to make sure you're moving your chickens across your land fast enough that the land will benefit rather than be harmed by the presence of those chickens. Okay. And there's no, one simple rule is 100 meat birds drop enough fertility for 1 acre of land.
Wow.
So over their 8-week lifespan, I think this is right if I'm remembering it correctly, but basically if you're thinking about like how many square feet of space these birds should move across in the course of their 8-week lifespan, they should take up an acre of ground when it's all said and done. If you're doing 100 birds, so 25 birds, they should move across roughly a quarter acre or 10,000 square feet. And this is, you know, just like a very, you know, general rule of thumb. Your soil location and other things make a difference. This is another good thing for people to know, it'll help you. Like with Cornish cross, if it gets really droughty, the pasture doesn't take their manure as well. So you might have to move to twice a day moving the chickens, or they'll begin to get sores on their feet. And this is how, if you want to know if your farmer who you buy chicken from is raising his meat birds well, the feet 90% of the time will tell you. If you pick up chickens' feet of a Cornish cross and they have sores forming, that means the management is off by the person overseeing those birds. So this is also helpful for us as homesteaders. Starting at week 4, we weekly check the feed on some of the chickens in the tractor. And if there's any signs of spores forming on the feet, we know our stocking density is too high, our pastures are too dry, or we're not moving the tractor fast enough, far enough, enough every day for the birds. And we might need to move to twice a day moving, or we might need to make some other change to our management.
And then for doing the chickens, is it true that basically they're more like a spring or a fall project and not a midsummer or a midwinter? Because extreme weather, like a midsummer, like in the middle of summer, because we're in the south here, so we're super humid. I don't think they'd last out there. Am I correct?
Yeah. So the winter issue is mostly they're going to cost more to raise in the winter. Sure. So a broiler meat chicken, depending on the quality of your pasture, can get anywhere from like 10 to 30% of its diet from the pasture.
Wow.
So in winter, you have to make up for that completely through more supplemental feed. That's one of the big, and obviously, and then on top of that, in winter, the animal, before an animal will put on weight, an animal has to regulate its body temperature. So in the winter, you know, in the summertime, 80% of the feed that actually gets converted into the chicken's body, because, you know, there's a step down of conversion. That's why so much fertility from a chicken goes out the back end. There's only so much, you know, it only gets a portion of what it eats actually absorbs.
Yes.
But in the summertime, you know, in the late spring, the late summer, you know, it might keep 80% of that goes into growth. But in the winter, of the feed it actually absorbs, half of that's just going to keep its butt warm because it's cold outside, you know, unless you're really, really far south. So it doesn't make economic sense to raise not just meat birds, but this is why, you know, our ancestors, why did everything get butchered in the fall? Mm. I mean, because it doesn't make economic sense to carry animals through winter where they're not going to gain weight because you're merely trying to maintain their condition. You're spending money merely to maintain body condition, not to really get any return. So our ancestors would butcher off everything but breeding stock for this reason, because they just knew like it's a negative sum gain to carry animals over winter when there's no free feed for them. And the temperature means you're burning through even more energy.
Okay, that makes complete sense. So you're going to be spending more money and you're going to be getting a less quality product at the end because you're doing it opposite of kind of how God intended with the seasons and how that goes. So that makes a lot of sense. And then probably summertime, I don't think that Cornish cross, they're really not bred to be able to regulate body temperature and stuff well, right? So they would just kind of keel over.
Yes. Yes. Now, it depends on your setup. I have a few friends who do raise Cornish cross, you know, in July, in August. Wow. but they're really doing it in a silvopasture type setup. So I did this when we sometimes will do on-farm classes, and I took a thermometer years ago and I showed people the difference in temperature between pasture spots, between cover cropped spots, and between a few spots of bare soil we had running around. And it's, you know, your pasture in July and August can be well over 100, 110 degrees in the pasture area, especially depending on the quality of pasture and the amount of moisture you've had. And so it's a real, we don't raise Cornish cross. We'll get our fall batch of birds in early August because we don't want to pay to have to keep the birds warm. And since you have to keep them over 90 degrees, you know, like the first 2-3 weeks of their life, they just like to be really warm. I'm like, well, let's let God pay that electric bill, not be running a light bulb in the bathroom all the time.
Yes.
you know, so, but I don't like having full size Cornish cross. You know, I don't like anything in July and August except for the beach.
You know? Yeah. Truth.
I wanted to write a book that basically said something like, you know, homestead fall, winter, and spring, and go to beach in the summer. That's like my mindset for homesteading. Once we hit July, I don't want a really complicated garden in July. I want a really well-managed garden where everything is mulched and there is no weeding to do. And the only thing I have to do is go out in the morning and harvest stuff and not be out in the garden on 105 degree full sun Kentucky afternoon and my poor white self baking like a potato chip. And so this is similar with, you know, Cornish cross meat birds. If you do want to raise them through the summer and you're farther south, you need to think through what are the coolest spots on your land, which are usually lower laying areas, have a moderate amount of tree cover so that you basically have something like a silvopasture. And if you have spaces like that, that are going to be significant, you know, our lower pasture on our farm is often 10 degrees, 15 degrees cooler than our middle and upper pasture land on the farm, especially in some of the moderately tree covered areas. So tree cover, silvopasture can make a really big difference to the time of year you can raise Cornish cross. And can you sneak them into July, into August? And you'll just have to see how it goes. But again, if you're raising them in July and August, you know, if something goes wrong with your water system, you or somebody has to be there. If they begin to show signs of heat stress, you're the one out there with a little fan and a spritz bottle of water, you know, keeping these chickens alive. I have 6 children. I have a complicated enough life. I like to avoid needless complications. I'm like, I raise my Cornish cross, you know, late April, May, we butcher in June, and then we raise them August, September, and we butcher right before I go to speak at Homesteaders of America. We always know, like, Homesteaders of America says this weekend, butchering, all the birds got to be gone before we leave.
Oh, I love that so much. So it's basically like working how God intended it within the seasons. And each season, I'm with you in the summertime because I was from the Pacific Northwest. And so we had hot summers, but they were dry. And so coming to Tennessee from there and experiencing, like, you just want to die if you have to be out there. So same, like, I'm out there in the morning watering everything and then back inside again. So with the birds then, okay, I want you to silvopasture. I don't know that I've heard that term before. So could you kind of define what that is a little bit just for me?
Silvopasture is tree pasture.
Okay.
So silvo is the Latin word for tree. It's, you know, so we tend, you know, Western people tend to think in very divided categories. You know, it's so like when you plan your garden, here's a tomato plant. And it's scorched earth all around your tomato plant. And here's another tomato plant. And there's nothing that's allowed to touch that tomato plant. And then here's a pepper plant. And you spend 5 months killing everything that might grow anywhere near one of these other plants. mm-hmm. then we have our pasture, and then we have our woodland, and we want to keep everything very separate. When in actuality, a lot of these systems function better blended together. Your garden plants will actually be infinitely healthier, less prone to disease and pests, if they are totally surrounded by other plants. You know, so like, I want as many roots as humanly possible in the ground around the vast majority of my garden plants. I want enough trees in my path. And this is partly too, you know, by the time we hit June and July, Tennessee, Kentucky, everywhere farther south, the amount of incoming solar energy that the sun is putting down on the land each day is significantly more than the plants can actually use. So our goal in the summertime is to actually try and give the plants a bit of a break, because the amount of energy coming in is more than all but the very healthiest of pastures and ecosystems can even partially fully begin to make use of. And the same in your garden.
Okay.
And so silvopasture, understanding that the ground actually doesn't need all of this energy, realizes that the ground is actually healthier having some trees spread out through it, because it reduces some of the sunlight and it reduces water loss. So the pasture holds water better. You have more biodiversity because now you have tree roots mixed in with pasture roots, and it makes a more resilient landscape than if you just have bare pasture going on forever and ever.
Fascinating. Okay, well, that's really good to hear. And honestly, so our 100 acres is all forest. So we've been slowly having someone come in and clear some, but I told them, and it was more because I thought it was beautiful, but now I'm glad I did it. I was like, don't take down the big trees, like take out the little stuff so we can get around them. I'm like, but leave those big old trees there because I love them. And I was thinking pasture for animals, like natural shade and stuff like that. But now that's good to know, just like in general for crop growing too. So that's fascinating. I feel like we could talk about that all in its own self, as like gardening and all that kind of stuff. I have three gardens right now. Gardening I love, but I do love, I'm very like, I like the delineation too, but I understand the concept of like not wanting that as well, and the companion planting and everything. So part of it's like mixing the beauty of it with like the fact that it is better to have, I'm doing my first in-ground garden this year. Everything else is actually up above in raised beds. So I'm doing like a row crop garden this year too, but we're deviating from the chickens. So for the chickens that we'll get back to, I want to talk to you about gardens now, but okay. For the chickens, is there, as they grow older, are they more susceptible to death? Like when you get them, when is the biggest chance that you're going to have a loss, or is it kind of just the whole way through, even if you're taking care of them and they have the water and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, there's just always a chance of random deaths with Cornish cross. And partly too, it really depends on how hard you push their growth. You know, we usually aim for about a 7 to 7.5 week growth cycle for ours. You can grow them in under 7 weeks, but you're risking more health issues, in my opinion, because you're pushing more growth into less time. Things are more likely to go wrong. So, you know, again, if you're a farmer, and you have, you know, 400 Cornish cross being raised every 8 weeks, a batch growing a little more slowly is a big problem. If you're a homesteader, what's an extra week to reduce some mortality? Because for you, it's not these other expenses at play and not this tight, you know, growing schedule you need to manage. You know, so I tell people, I usually like to allot on a calendar 8 to 8.5 weeks for our Cornish in terms of their life cycle. And if we finish up a little bit earlier than that, that's great. Now, we also like our Cornish cross to be bigger when we butcher them. We're a family of eight. A 4-pound chicken is a snack for me and my oldest son. It just doesn't do anything for me.
Sure.
So you know, we like a live weight on our Cornish cross of a little over 7 pounds.
Okay.
You know, really like a 7 to 8 pound live weight. So we're getting a 6 pound butchered dressed weight. And especially if you're going to be breaking the birds down into cuts. So if you're not just going to be taking whole broilers, but you're going to be cutting up the legs, taking off the thighs and breaking the birds down into their, you know, the component parts for later reassembly at a meal. Bigger is also much better for the cuts, in my opinion. It's both easier to make the cuts, but nothing is as demoralizing as, you know, butchering Cornish cross when they only reach 5 pounds. So you get like a 3.5, 3.75 pound dressed bird. Hmm. And you just have these tiny legs. You know, the legs look like wings, and your husband's just like one bite, and he's like, now he's still hungry. And since most of your cost in raising Cornish, a lot of it is the cost of the chicks, I would prefer to run them to a bigger size because that brings down our price per pound. You know, so if you paid $3 per chick and your butchered bird only weighs a little over 3 pounds, you have $1 per pound just in the chick. If my final dressed butchered weight of the bird is 6 pounds, I only have 50 cents per pound in the chick. Mm. So to me, it's much more economical to give yourself a little more time on that raising curve and push them to a slightly bigger size. Unless, you know, a slightly bigger chicken is really going to bother you. But then, you know, like, you can always just break the chicken. And if you're a small family and there's only like 3 of you, there's only 4 of you, and you raise bigger chickens, well, just half the chickens, you know, cut them in half and cook half of a chicken at a time. You know, you have options to deal with this, but.
Okay. So beginner question then, as far as once you move them outside, do you just give them unlimited food? I know that you're supposed to give a higher protein. They say about what, 20-22%. Is that out and accessible all day long? Or are you trying to push them into foraging first and then providing food after? Like, just as a very basic beginner who knows nothing, how do you establish their daily routine outside?
Well, everybody's going to have a different opinion on this. I know tons of farms that do always available feed. I know some farms who do 12 hours on, 12 hours off. I know some people who do, they move them to fresh pasture. They want to see them forage first and then they give feed. You know, some of this goes back to the totality of your raising system. So like for us, whenever we get new pigs on our farm, these are piglets. You're now mama. You get to show the piglet what food is. So my kids know when we're raising pigs in the morning, we go cut fodder for them from around the farm. And that's what they get fed first, because we want to accustom their palate to foraging for food. And then we'll give them feed a little bit later after they've had that, you know, because feed is basically like candy. I forget who once described this, but, you know, modern feed is really like candy to animals. It's super tasty because it's really, really high calorie. Just absolutely, you know, does them in. So like with our meat birds, as soon as we have them in the brooder, from the very beginning, we're trying to get them accustomed to other things as food. So we're dropping worms from our worm bins in. We're putting a little dish of raw milk because, you know, if you have milk that's going sour, absolutely amazing food for meat birds.
Okay.
So we're getting them accustomed to having a broader palate. So they're not, I think Joel Salatin always calls like the chicken that just never leaves the feeder. It just like lays by the
feeder. Yeah.
He calls them welfare chickens. We don't want welfare chickens. We want well chickens.
Okay.
And so part of it is just your management of really encouraging and trying to help the birds into more natural behavior. So like in your brooder, don't just offer only feed. Give them other things to eat, other things to try, other things to do, so that when they get out onto pasture, they're already familiar with these things and their little brains are like, oh, this is also edible. You know, okay. I want to eat this bug. I want to try it.
That's fascinating. Okay. Because I honestly, that was the first I'd heard of that. So I'm glad that now we've only had them for a few days, so I can start having the kids go and grab things and throw it in there for them to kind of get accustomed to, because I just assumed it was mostly, you know, the feed. So that's like, thank you. That you're literally, I'm taking notes as we're doing this on things I'm going to change as we go through this.
Because we put stuff in their feeder, you know, so like we'll cut clover and chop it up and we'll drop it into the feeder because they already think of, well, whatever is in this feeder is food. So when new things show up in the feeder, they're more inclined to give it a try than if you throw it somewhere else randomly in the brooder. You know, sometimes okay. They will, but again, there's genetic, you know, there's, you know, this aspect of animal raising, when you're raising animals without a mom who models for them this kind of stuff. There's a really great book I recommend everybody read by a guy by the name of Fred Provenza. And it's a book called Nourished. And he's been an animal nutrition scientist out west for decades.
Okay.
And his book is just a fascinating look at how animals stay healthy, how animals choose what they eat and why they eat it, how animals pass down this knowledge, you know, parents to children, herds and stuff. And it'll give you some, it'll help you think better about the animals you're raising over time and how you teach them healthy habits. And eventually, if you get to the point of having, you know, closed herds on your land, why that's so beneficial over time to the animals learning proper, you know, animal eating and behavior. But since most of us are raising a lot of animals without the moms, we have to play the role of mom. And we're the dinner enforcer, no dessert until you eat your other stuff.
Oh, I love looking at it from that way. I've never really thought about that before, but I love a good book. So I will definitely find that. Okay. So let's just say we have got them established. It's like around butcher time. We've successfully made it to that point. Butchering day, even to me, is very intimidating just because we haven't done it before. And I've watched the videos and everything, but it's so different when you actually go to do it. So when you butcher day, what do you do like the day before? What kind of like products do you recommend to help with that? How many people do you usually need? And how long should I expect it to take for beginners who've never done it before? Because I haven't, I guess I need to see if there's anyone I know that's butchering that maybe I can go help them and get some experience. Because of right now, nothing.
Yeah. So I always tell people, if at all possible, before you butcher your own Cornish cross, if you've never butchered other animals, and especially you've never butchered off some of your laying birds, go help somebody else a couple times. It will make your butchering day 1,000,000% better.
Okay.
It's just, there's no replacement for learning at somebody else's expense. So, you know, even if they don't give you a free, just go and help. And don't expect anything in return, because again, like our family, me with three of my kids can butcher 30 chickens in about 75 minutes. We'll wake up, you know, in June, the night before, we'll get our butchering set up, you know, so the boys will know we have checklists already made. A lot of this stuff is going to be in my chicken butchering guide. That's okay. Going to be available from Roots and Harvest. And so we have clear checklists where, hey, like, this is what we do 1 week before butchering. This is what we do 5 days before butchering. This is what we do the day before butchering.
Okay.
And everybody knows, like, these are the things we get done so that the morning of butchering goes smoothly. You know, like, we're not sharpening knives the morning of butchering. We're not going, oh, do we have enough ice for chilling these freshly butchered birds the morning of butchering? You know, we're not going, oh, did this piece of equipment get tested because it's been sitting in a barn all winter? Is it actually going to turn on this morning? All of that, you want to eliminate all needless complication on butchering morning. You have one job the morning you're butchering, and that is to butcher. And you don't want to have any other jobs. You don't want to be doing equipment testing. You don't want to be doing knife sharpening. All you want to do is wake up and butcher. And so for us, I'll usually wake up a little after six. I'll get the scalder going. Caleb will start killing the first couple chickens around, you know, 6:45 or so. Other children get out there by 7, and by 8 o'clock, we're done. And wow. Somebody else is going to do cleanup. We go get washed up. Somebody else is cooking breakfast. And we're having our normal breakfast 8:30, 8:45, 9 o'clock. We've tried to make butchering something that our kids look forward to, not dread. This is a good thing for adults to think about. If your kids look at something on your homestead or farm as something they dread, you have poor management going on. And this isn't to say that like every kid is going to think killing a bunch of chickens is like the same as going to the beach. But our kids, I can say, because a bunch of them are in the room listening because they love to eavesdrop. But kids, do you enjoy butchering day? Yeah, like my son is saying really fun. My 11-year-old daughter, who's my 11-year-old daughter, she's grimacing. How old are you now? She's 18, whatever age you are. She loves butchering. She likes butchering rabbits better because it's
so much easier.
Such a simpler process.
Really?
You know, and like all of my kids for this one, like actually really enjoy butchering day. They think it's a ton of fun, and we make it special. We put on music. I bought a speaker that hangs outside. We throw on some hymns and music. We chit chat. We butcher. We have a nice breakfast when we're done, and we always save all of the chickens we break down into parts. We save all of the wings. And that night, we always have a special meal of barbecued chicken wings.
Oh, that's so cool. It's like a party.
Yeah, we tried to make it something everybody looks forward to. You know, yeah, it is. We have to wait 2 more months for chicken wings.
But that's so amazing because that's where you get the longevity of a family wanting to continue on it and not getting so burnt out and thinking it's a chore that they go move into the city. You know, like this is establishing such a great foundation for them to hopefully continue on what we're starting, you know? I love that.
Yeah, and I think a lot of homes, you know, because the parents are the ones who are into homesteading. And I always say this at my talks, like Homesteaders of America, adults are dumb. You know, like an adult will sit out there in the July heat, hand weeding a garden for hours and hours. And they won't understand why their kids think this is dumb. I'm like, because the kid's smarter than you. And they realize this is just dumb. Nobody wants to do this with their life. Like, and obviously you'll do it if you're going to die otherwise because there's not enough food.
Sure.
And so we've really tried to make homesteading enjoyable. Reminding our kids that, you know, God made us to work. Work is not always enjoyable. Things go wrong in a fallen world. But you were made to work. And work should be enjoyable, but it's not always going to be enjoyable. So suck it up sometimes because, but as much as possible as parents, you don't want to needlessly make life drudgery for your family. And a lot of homesteaders, I fear the reason they don't reproduce is because the way they homestead is a real turnoff to their children.
Yeah.
You know, but getting back to butchering, basically butchering day, proper preparation is just everything. Having the right equipment, knowing what you need, having sufficient experience, or paying somebody to come help you that day. If you do not have a friend who's skilled, who will just come help you and walk you through the ropes the first time, if you got to pay somebody $50 to come help you for 2 hours, it will absolutely be worth it. Now, hopefully you have friends and other people who you either can go learn from or who will come help you. But if you don't, I would absolutely pay somebody to avoid disaster and sorrow and pain that morning. because nothing is like a butchering day. Nothing is like a butchering morning that drags on into the afternoon.
Yeah.
You know, like you wake up and you're supposed to butcher 30 chickens and you start at 7 o'clock and now it's lunchtime and you're like two thirds of the way done. That is such a demoralizing. So set yourself up for success. You know, there's some areas you can afford to make mistakes. You can start seeds, and if only half of the seeds make it, it's not that big a deal because you should have started extra anyway, because then you have plants to give away. You know, so there's some areas as homesteaders, you can afford to make mistakes. You can eat losses and it not be a big deal. But when it comes to butchering day, I want that day to go as smoothly as possible. So as far as depends on me as the one in charge, I want to make sure everything is ready for us to go well. And I already have a good game plan. If something does break that morning, how we're going to navigate it. What is our fallback plan? So that, you know, because again, everybody else is their mood. Everything hinges on my management. So as a dad, I just know up front, like, this is on me. This, you know, so set yourself up for success for butchering. Have a good plucker. Have a good scalder. You know, those are non-negotiable. Have sharp knives that you're not sharpening that morning. You know, have sufficient ice already. Make sure you have sufficient freezing and chilling space. And again, that's why we wrote this butchering guide, is that there's a lot of things when you work through the butchering guide I wrote, you're going to be like, oh, I would have never thought of that.
Yeah.
Until I was sitting there after butchering a bunch of chickens and I was like, oh, these need to like rest at fridge temperatures for 24 hours. Where do I put 20 chickens? I don't have an extra refrigerator.
Yes, you know, we do.
Well, we do have an extra fridge. You know, and we have large cool, you know, sufficient ice and stuff, you know. So just already having all those boxes checked and really having a clear game plan, because you're not, again, you're not just butchering that day. You have to bring the birds to the butchering area. You have to make sure feed was properly withheld. You have to butcher the birds. You have to rinse and wash the birds. You have to chill the birds. Then you have to let the birds rest. Then you have to package the birds. You know, it's
you have to do cutting too.
Yeah. And then obviously if you want to break the birds down,
yeah,
you have to cut them down. And then you might want to have a backpacker for backpacking the cut up pieces of the birds. And so it's, you know, you can always start just doing whole chickens, chilling the whole chickens, and then freezing the whole chickens. Super easy place to start. But the more you add on to this process, the proper planning is just everything.
Yeah, I can. That is like, I'm going to read the book. Obviously, I'm going to be like grabbing the copy and checking that out, because it's one of those things to where when you're a beginner, you don't know what you don't know, and you can only prepare yourself so much. And so I'm going to go on our little forum that's local and be like, is there anyone butchering chickens? I'll come help, because I just love everything you've said, but just like the community of it is, you're not doing this to just be your own little ecosystem by yourself. Like, you're finding and coming alongside other people that are in a similar situation who want the same thing as you, and you're working together, which you can accomplish so much more. And there's so much wisdom that can be shared that way as well. And so you have shared so much wisdom with me today and with all the people who are going to listen to this. And I know it's just going to be super encouraging. Is there anything else that you would like to touch on before we finish up here? And how can listeners follow you, find you? Obviously, you've written several books. You have your other one coming out. I know you're doing a conference here pretty soon. And so how can everyone stay in touch and just continue to learn from you?
Yeah, Joel Salatin and I put on a twice a year event called Rogue Food. It's the Rogue Food Conference is the website. And if you've never been to Polyface and can sneak away in May, it's going to be a fabulous 2 days at Polyface, where Joel gives you a tour of the farm. Two great meals from Polyface, a bunch of great speakers. So that event is May 17th and 18th, Rogue Food Conference. I'm going to be down in Tennessee twice speaking over the next few months. So
yay!
Tennessee followers, I'm going to be speaking at Rory Feek's Homestead Festival.
Okay.
And giving like my most favorite, my elderberry talk. And then I'm going to be speaking at like a Bitcoin conference, which is crazy. But I'm going to, you know, so I'm going to be down in Tennessee. I'm going to be speaking at Homesteaders of America. Mm-hmm. And if you want to learn to butcher chicken at Homesteaders of America in Virginia, we're doing a pre-conference butchering workshop where you will get to watch us butcher chickens, and then we will help you butcher some of your own chickens as part of the workshop. And you'll get my butchering guide as part of the workshop. And I think there's like 4 slots left for that workshop. So if you're going to Homesteaders of America and you really want to improve your butchering game, that workshop, my kids are going to be there. We're going to be teaching it together as a family. And it's called, you know, like chicken butchering for the whole family. Because, you know, down to our 6-year-old helps with chicken butchering.
That is so cool.
Speaking, you know, butchering was a family and community activity. You know, like, you know, your neighbor down the road, you went over there to help him butcher off his hogs and a steer 1 week. And then he came up the road and helped you all do that the next week. And I love butchers. A butcher, I never complain about butchers that charge a fair price, because once you've butchered a pig or butchered a larger animal, you realize how much, you know, you're like, wow, like taking this to the butcher is a deal if you have a good local butcher to work with. But it's a community event, and we want to regain these kind of skills where, when necessary, we can break down larger animals. We can do it in a way that's enjoyable for everybody involved. And we're developing communities with really deep pools of skill-based resources so that we can help each other.
That is so amazing. Yeah, I just feel like in the last, and maybe it's just because we're digging more into the homesteading movement, but the last few years, there's just so many amazing resources like you, like Joel, and they're all over. Like even in the Pacific Northwest, they have a really great one over here. There's so many in Virginia and Tennessee. My husband was like, oh, where do you want to go on vacation this year? And I was like, I want to go to Homesteaders of America. I want to meet all these people. Like that would be a vacation to me. That's so exciting. I just geek out over the learning process and everything. There's just so much to learn, and I am a learner. So I'm just like, give it all to me. Take notes all the time. So I'm just, thank you so much for being on here today. Thank you for being part of this movement, for helping us all. We just really appreciate you. And I hope to talk to you more. I would love to talk to you about gardening and all the things too. So maybe a different podcast, a different day.
Yeah, we
thank
can
you.
Schedule a gardening one. And
yay!
Everybody enjoys the eclipse.
Yes. Yes. Thank you so much, John. We'll talk to you later.
Great. Bye.
If you found this episode inspiring or encouraging today, I would love for you to give it a 5-star review, send it to some friends who are in the homestead movement, and let's share this knowledge and learn together. Thanks so much, friends. We'll see you next time.